It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
I'm Greg Jarrett.
I'm Sandra Smith.
I'm Charles Payne, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Friday, March 31st, 2023. I'm Lisa Brady. America is in uncharted territory with the indictment of former President Donald Trump.
There are 1,000 examples of our justice system being corrupted by politics. This may just be the most recent example, but it is by no means the only one.
I'm Chris Foster. More kids are getting a head start on their careers and avoiding student loans by choosing apprenticeships over college.
This is attractive to people who are concerned about outcomes. Right now, that tends to be folks who don't have a lot of money to go to college and are going to have to borrow to go in.
And I'm David Marcus. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
No sitting or former U.S. president has ever faced criminal charges. Until now, Donald Trump indicted by a New York City grand jury. A spokesperson for the Manhattan District Attorney, Alvin Bragg, confirming it last night, saying they had contacted Trump's attorney to coordinate his surrender to the DA's office for arraignment on an indictment that remains under seal for now. But it's believed to center around a hush money payment to adult film actress Stormy Daniels during the 2016 presidential campaign, made by then-Trump attorney Michael Cohen, who says Trump reimbursed him, and whether that can be elevated to covering up an unreported campaign donation. The grand jury was also reportedly probing a payment to former Playboy model Karen McDougal. The former president says he's 100% innocent and has denied an affair with either woman.
Well, it's shocking for sure. And it really is a slippery slope when we start indicting our political opponents, particularly active candidates for office.
Florida Republican Congresswoman Kat Kamak thinks this will backfire on the DA and Democrats.
Instead of cleaning up the streets of New York, a George Soros-backed DA is focused on indicting a former president, and that is priority number one. Give me a break.
Trump calls the indictment political persecution and election interference and an attack on our country by thugs and radical left monsters. Trump attorney Joe Tacopina telling Fox's Sean Hannity.
There is no crime. I know the facts. I know the law. And I really want to see where this is going to go.
House Speaker Kevin McCarthy says DA Alvin Bragg has irreparably damaged the country in an attempt to interfere in the 2024 election. But Democrats are calling the indictment long overdue and proof that no one is above the law. California Congressman Adam Schiff, who led a Trump impeachment probe, says the indictment is sobering and, while unprecedented, is deeply and fundamentally necessary to preserve the rule of law. Several other investigations of Trump continue, including the special counsel probe related to classified documents and the Capitol riot, and in Georgia, the effort to overturn the 2020 election results. Negotiations are underway on when and how Trump would turn himself in for arraignment in the New York City case, possibly early next week.
The indictment, particularly if it's what we call a speaking indictment, will go into lots of detail about what they plan to prove or think they have.
Trey Gowdy is a former congressman and prosecutor.
That said, whether you like the defendant or do not like the defendant, we do have a presumption of innocence, and that is more than just lip service.
He's also the host of the Trey Gowdy podcast and Sunday Night in America with Trey Gowdy, and he has a new book, Start, Stay, or Leave, The Art of Decision Making.
You really genuinely are presumed innocent until such time as you admit your guilt or a jury of your peers concludes otherwise. The indictment, and this is what juries are told in court, is not even evidence. So, I mean, it's a legal way, a formal way of charging someone, but it's not evidence. So the old prosecutor in me has seen indictments that juries rejected, and I have seen indictments that juries convicted on. So let's wait and read the indictment, and then we won't have to wonder anymore.
It's been reported that the Justice Department passed on bringing charges over this. Does that weaken the Manhattan DA's case and lend credence to the argument that he is, in fact, stretching a misdemeanor into a felony?
Yes. In the court of public opinion, the jury will never hear about that. The jury will never be told that another prosecutorial entity with potential jurisdiction took a pass. But in the court of public opinion, and I was both a state and a federal prosecutor, but the feds only bring cases when there is a significant likelihood of a conviction, which is why they have a conviction rate, you know, well above 90%. The conviction rate's a lot less in state court. However, let me say this. There are four that we know of ongoing investigations into former President Trump. I think by far this is the weakest factually, legally. You have witness credibility issues. You have genuine statute of limitations issues, not to mention the fact that you have to prove that this was done in furtherance of another crime for it to be a felony. And look, federal prosecutors in New York are among the best in the world. The fact that they took a look at this and took a pass should influence the court of public opinion, but the jury in a Manhattan courtroom will never hear about that.
Trump's son Eric is calling this an opportunistic targeting of a political opponent in a campaign year. And Trump himself calls this election interference. Can that be a winning defense for him in this case?
Only if you consider what we call jury nullification to be a winning defense. And that's when the jury says, we're really not interested in the law and the facts. We don't think you should have brought this case. I think the most famous example of jury nullification was the O.J. Simpson case. I really don't know anyone who could look at those facts and conclude that O.J. Simpson did not kill his wife and her friend. However, the jury ignored, in my judgment, the law and the facts because they thought some higher offense had been created. So the fact that it's an election year, ironically enough, does influence whether or not you bring charges. I think the Department of Justice has a rule that they are not going to bring certain charges within a certain time period on either side of an election because they don't want to interfere. On the other hand, Jim Comey had a pretty famous press conference and then a later issued a statement that many Democrats think adversely impacted Secretary Clinton in 2016. It is never good for prosecutors to be either in reality or perceived as trying to interfere with elections. But that's not a legal defense. That is a defense in the court of public opinion, and it may be a jury nullification issue.
Well, Trump's defense lawyers say they will vigorously fight this. How do they do that? Where do they start? Where should they start?
You start with the indictment itself. You start with the statute of limitations, whether or not this case can even legally be brought. Some jurisdictions do not have statutes of limitations. In fact, my own home state of South Carolina does not. But many do, which means you have to bring a case within X amount of time of when the alleged offense took place. So you defend it there on the law first, and then you try to vigorously defend it on the facts. But judges are very loath to dismiss indictments. It has to be clearly a legal violation to have indicted someone, or else they're going to let the trial go forward. Now, it may be that you don't have the facts. I've seen judges toss indictments in the middle of a trial, but only after the prosecution has a chance to call witnesses. And again, that gets to the witness credibility issue. Michael Cohen went to prison for lying to Congress. That is not the kind of witness that a prosecutor would want to hinge her or his case on. Doesn't mean the witness cannot tell the truth. It just means the jury is less likely to believe that they are. I don't know what all the Manhattan DA has. I don't know what the evidence is. We probably won't know unless and until there's a trial. But to vigorously defend something means, number one, attack the indictment is either not, you know, the DA either didn't have jurisdiction or there's some fatal legal flaw before you ever get to the facts.
The former president, of course, now lives in Florida, where the Republican governor, Ron DeSantis, believed to be considering his own run for president, is criticizing the indictment, but is also saying he's not going to help with any extradition. How much does that matter procedurally?
Oh, gosh. I think procedurally, not at all. I think we're in an environment right now where, you know, if Governor DeSantis doesn't have the Florida National Guard, you know, outside of Mar-a-Lago, some people are going to criticize him. My guess is, you know, because President Trump believes that he is legally and factually innocent, that he would not fight extradition. He probably will take the tack that he welcomes the opportunity to, quote, prove his innocence, although he doesn't have to. You're presumed innocent. You don't have to prove it.
So far, legal troubles have bounced off Trump in terms of polling. Will an actual indictment be any different for his 2024 campaign? And how should other Republican candidates, including his Republican rivals, handle all of this?
I don't think it's going to impact him at all in the primary. I think in the old days, maybe a couple of decades ago, the allegations themselves would have given some people pause. I don't recall hearing the phrase, I don't use the phrase porn star because I don't know what it means, but a porn actress, we'll go with that. I don't remember hearing that phrase much in the past with respect to presidential candidates. But voters have already factored in whether they think the allegations are true or not with respect to Stormy Daniels or Kara McDougal or anyone else. So I don't think his numbers are going to go down at all. They'll probably go up because people like me, for instance, think this is the wrong case to start with. In terms of a general election, I don't know how many people are left undecided in our country anymore, quite frankly. I think that number is narrowing. How should his primary opponents handle it? I think they should handle it by saying he is presumed innocent. We're going to let the process play out. I doubt any of them know the facts, and I guarantee you not a one of them knows all the facts. So if you don't know the facts, I don't know why you would be weighing in on it. Other than to say he's presumed innocent, let the process play itself out. And if you say anything more than that, then I think you're saying too much.
Is this only a weak case in your opinion, or does it also, as some Republicans argue, prove weaponization of government and abuse of power and politics in play in the Manhattan DA's office?
I think we've had a problem in this realm for a while now, unfortunately. I know this is wildly unpopular, and I'll probably get a lot of less than complimentary emails, but I used to tell people it's wrong to chant, lock her up. I don't care how much you do not like Secretary Clinton. She was never indicted. She certainly wasn't convicted by a jury of her peers. She wasn't sentenced by a judge. And in this country, we don't lock people up unless all three of those things have happened. There have been people chanting, lock Trump up, well before this indictment. Again, we don't do that in this country. So the notion that we're going to kind of suspend due process, suspend the presumption of innocence, go after our political rivals, or in some instances, the crowd doesn't even wait for an indictment. They don't even wait for the investigation. It's just this catatonic chant, lock him up or lock her up. That is a dangerous place for our country to be. We don't lock people up unless a jury of their peers have convicted them. So I think this has been going on. It's terrible. I say that as a prosecutor, not a recovering congressman. The best hope we have left for this republic is a justice system that is worthy of our respect. And when you have FBI directors who insert themselves into not just one but two presidential campaigns, when you have the belief that her investigation was kind of soft-handed, but they went after President Trump very, very hard on pretty scant facts, I think we've crossed that bridge, unfortunately. And what we need is an attorney general and district attorneys. Think about what Alvin Bragg did the day he took office. He issued a memo with all the things he was not going to prosecute. That is not what prosecutors do. They don't sit there and second guess a legislative body and say, look, I know you say this is a crime, but I say it's not. So there are 1,000 examples of our justice system being corrupted by politics. This may just be the most recent example, but it is by no means the only one.
Trey Gowdy, thank you so much for your time.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.
This is David Marcus with your Fox News commentary coming up.
The average college tuition has more than doubled over the last 30 years. $10,000 a year in-state at public schools, $38,000 at private schools, according to the College Board. The Education Department says it takes student loan borrowers 17 years on average to pay them off. Now, some kids and their families are saying no thanks. College enrollment is down. Apprenticeships, though, learning on the job, are becoming more popular, and not just for trades like carpenters, electricians, and plumbers.
Yeah, it's for a long time in this country, the apprenticeship has been in the trades, but they're expanding.
Douglas Belkin covers higher education for the Wall Street Journal. He wrote an article about students turning away from college and toward apprenticeships.
For a lot of reasons, and they're moving into insurance, banking, cybersecurity, kind of all sorts of different places.
So what typically happens? Do I have this right? You work part-time for a company, they pay for a degree or some training along the way, and then maybe you have a leg up as far as getting a full-time job when it's done. Is that about right?
That's pretty much it. You take a general study course in college, the first couple of years of college or community college often. You don't have to go do that route. Then there's training within the company, and then you're working, and you have a mentor, so you're learning on the job. So the idea is that you graduate your apprenticeship in a few years, and you are, you know, skilled and connected and aligned with an industry.
So what kind of kids are going this route, are you finding? What don't they want about a four-year university?
Debt. Everybody's terrified of debt, and they're terrified of getting a degree that costs them a lot of money that doesn't land them a job, often because they don't have good work experience. And so this is attractive to people who are concerned about outcomes. Right now, that tends to be folks who don't have a lot of money to go to college and are going to have to borrow to go in.
In general, and I know it's it varies widely from industry to industry, but is college still, as a whole, a good bang for your buck? Do you still make that money back?
Yes, but college is a good bet if you graduate. Only 60% graduate if a four-year degree in 6 years. If you study something that aligns with the market, maybe a third of the kids end up studying something that they don't end up working in. So what you end up getting is between a third and a half of kids who graduate, who start college and graduate and get a job leveraging their credential. The rest drop out or get a job that doesn't demand a college degree.
Okay. We'll talk about the kids you talked to for the journal article and the apprenticeships they're doing, just so people can have a couple of real world examples.
So the kids I interviewed for this story are working in white-collar apprenticeships because these are sort of the new curve on this. And they were both looking closely at colleges. They both had good aid offers from schools, but they were also both concerned about those things, about debt and about not having experience and having a hard time cracking the job market when they graduated. They have experiences with siblings who are both in that situation. So they turn to these apprenticeships, both in the insurance industry, that offer them, you know, training. The sort of odd part for them is they're working in offices with people who are their parents' age. So there's a kind of a cultural misfit, but they sort of get over that and they learn from them and they get mentored by a lot of them. And they learn skills that are necessary to do the jobs that these adults are doing in these companies.
Yeah, and you move through the company a bit. It's not like you're just learning how to be an insurance adjuster or an insurance salesperson or whatever, like you move through IT and whatever else that company entails.
Right. So you do sort of stints for a couple of months in different parts of the company so that you can learn how the business works and then focus on something that you're more interested in. That's sort of the ideal afterwards.
Yeah. That sounds sort of like college. You take a few classes and then focus on what you're interested in. Some of these apprenticeships are very competitive, you write, with a lower acceptance rate than some Ivy League schools.
Yeah, there's a value to this model, and that's being discovered as these things begin to spread out. So one of the apprenticeship programs that I connected with had 1,500 applicants this year for 100 spots. So that's, you know, that's 6.6% acceptance rate. That's Ivy League level.
So what's the application process? Is it similar to college where do they even look at grades and extracurriculars and all that stuff, or is it just, how do they do it?
It's more hands-on, and it struck me as more extensive because the company is making a significant commitment in the kid, and they want to make sure that they're going to stick with it. They're going to have the capacity to get it done. So they do things. They bring the students in and have them work in teams and observe them. Are they good, able to communicate internally or, you know, with in small groups? They pay attention to things like their ability to pay attention to detail. They do look at grades. Some of them have written essays. But there are, you know, four or five steps to these application processes, and it takes a few months because they're winnowing down a lot of kids, and they want to make sure that they work out. The result is that the retention rates are really high, over 80%, 90% in the folks that I spoke to.
I guess that you're right. The difference is these companies are investing in the kid, spending money on the kid, where colleges, especially not necessarily competitive colleges, they'll take any kid's money.
Right. So, you know, there's a big debate in higher education. Should universities have skin in the game? Should they, if a student fails out, graduates with debt or doesn't graduate with debt, should the school be penalized for that? Right now, the answer is pretty much no. What they do care about, especially the selective schools, is that the kids succeed because it reflects on their reputation and their capacity to educate people. So they want, you know, they want to earn a good reputation. That isn't always, doesn't always work that way, but that's the idea of how it's supposed to work.
One of the criticisms of traditional internship programs, not apprenticeship programs, but internship programs that are connected to getting your college degree, is that they're mostly helpful and useful for people, for kids who have the financial wherewithal through their families to essentially work for free. Where if a kid is working their way through college, well, I can't take classes, do my job, and then take another basically unpaid job. This apprenticeship thing seems to negate some of that.
Right. These kids are making good money for college kids, you know, $30,000, $40,000 a year with benefits and vacation for working part-time during the school year and full-time during the summer. So that's better than most kids are making if they're in the service industry or something. So I think there's a sort of a level of respect. And also this, the companies are demanding that you're able to produce, not that they expect you to know so much when you get in, but that you're able to work hard and focus.
Yeah. You write in the same article that a lot of employers, or more employers, are dropping degree requirements. Is that because they need a bigger pool or because they are realizing that degrees aren't necessarily relevant to the job?
I think it's both. You know, there's a tremendous skills mismatch in the country right now, and there's also a huge demand for labor. So a lot of the purpose of college degrees traditionally, the last generation, has been a signal in the noise to figure out if a student has the perseverance to get through a four-year program, but maybe not so much what they've learned. So now employers are beginning to look more specifically at skills as opposed to credentials, and this fits into that mode.
Well, you do acknowledge in this article that there is an argument for a broader education as opposed to what might be a narrower education that you're getting with these apprenticeships. If the industry that you're apprenticing in takes a downturn, then if those are the skills you have, the argument goes, then you might have been better off leaning on a broader education. I don't know if that's true.
Right. So the purpose of going to college ultimately is to learn to think critically, to synthesize information, to think for yourself, and to be able to learn. Some schools do this. A lot of schools don't. A lot of kids graduate with not particularly well-improved critical thinking skills. But if you do college well, then you come out a sharper, clearer thinker, and you are able to learn and adapt in an economy that's changing quickly. And that's how things should work. Apprenticeships don't preclude learning to think critically by any means, but they do focus on a narrow set of skills. And if those skills, you know, get washed away by technology or whatnot, then you're going to have to adapt. The question is, will you be as adaptable?
I know some schools, colleges, universities have dropped tuitions in response to complaints that degrees don't carry the value that they used to. Are schools responding to that complaint?
I mean, there's a tremendous scramble right now among colleges to attract students. There's, I think, some fire sales going on at some schools. A lot of the, when you see sticker prices being reduced, a little bit of that is smoke and mirrors because very few kids actually pay the sticker price. So some schools are saying, well, we're knocking our price down from $60,000 to $32,000. But the reality is the average price kids were paying after grants was, you know, $32,000.
Right. Nobody was paying that 60.
Yeah.
Are colleges going to fail? What is college even going to be? You cover this for a living. What is college going to be in 5 years, 10 years, 15 years? Is it going to be like it was whatever 75 years ago when college was really not meant for everybody?
It's really hard to say where things are heading in a short period of time. There's a bunch of things that are clearly happening right now. There's an enrollment crisis at a lot of schools. The weakest schools that charge high tuition and have low endowments are struggling the most, and they're beginning to close. That's happening in the Midwest and the Northeast, where the population is upside down. You know, there's just not enough kids graduating high schools. Schools are working to align themselves with the labor market, and they're doing, you know, there's progress being made there. So you see a lot happening in terms of the curriculum shifting so that kids feel that they'll get a good job. You know, some schools have placed the guidance counselor on the center of the quad to sort of send the message that we care what happens after you graduate, so you don't end up in your parents' basement. Yeah. So the pendulum tends to swing depending on how tight the labor market is and how much, you know, slack there is. Okay. If and when there's a lot of folks who are unemployed, companies were more likely to be choosier and demand that they get these credentials before they even apply.
Douglas Belkin out of Chicago covers higher education, among other things, for the Wall Street Journal. Douglas, thank you.
Thanks very much.
And now, some good news with Tanya J. Powers.
Saichi Sano is turning 90 this year, and if you're thinking he's slowing down due to his age, think again. He has a history of tackling challenges, like climbing Mount Fuji at age 80. Sano, who lives in Japan, also loves to surf and has been recognized by Guinness World Records as the oldest male to surf. He started his own business earlier in life and still runs a company that supplies timber to construction companies, putting in a 9-to-5 shift these days. He says surfing is his stress reliever and catches waves most weekends in Inoshima, the small island that hosted sailing for the recent Tokyo Olympics and was the harbor for the 1964 Games. He said he was inspired to take up the sport by an employee at his local bank who was always tan and didn't look like a typical banker. The banker said his secret was surfing. So Sano followed up and found a teacher. As for what's next, Sano says he's ruled out bungee jumping but might try rock climbing. But he's not abandoning his passion for surfing. He says he wants to try to surf until he's 100, saying, quote, "I take better care of myself when I have goals like this." Tanya J. Powers, Fox News.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Janice Dean, Fox News senior meteorologist. Be sure to subscribe to the Janice Dean podcast at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to spread the sunshine.
Subscribe to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com.
It's time for your Fox News commentary.
David Marcus.
What's on your mind?
Patriotism, tolerance, religious observance, and community involvement are all on steep declines, according to new polling published in the Wall Street Journal. And if we're being honest, the results are scary. The declining numbers in almost every area of civic life are not just a threat to civility and social cohesion, they are a threat to America's national security. The numbers strike a stark and quite serious chord. In 1998, 70% of Americans surveyed said that patriotism was very important to them. Today, just 38%. And that's down from 61% in just 4 years. There are similar dips in the numbers for how important religion, down 33%, is, or community involvement, down 35%. In fact, the only object that has surged in importance, according to this polling, is money, which gained a cool 12 percentage points. Perhaps the most shocking and dangerous result of the survey involves tolerance of others and their views. In 2019, 80% of Americans backed this foundational American value. Today, that has dwindled to a mere 58%. Placed on top of each other, these numbers present a pernicious palimpsest of an America that is changing and not for the better. We are now a nation with less pride in our flag, a nation without a God to obey, a nation in which communities are crumbling as Americans distrust and even hate each other. If these numbers are a cold cup of coffee for a country that needs to wake up to its internal divisions, they are a Christmas present to our geopolitical foes who not only thrive on, but also stoke this disastrous divisiveness. When Special Counsel Robert Mueller dropped his report on foreign interference in the 2016 election, we were so focused on the guilt or innocence of then-President Donald Trump that we mostly ignored the report's main finding, that Russia's internet troll farms were not so much trying to swing an election as make Americans revile each other. While it's not entirely clear just how much of an impact foreign information operations, not just from Russia, but also from China, Iran, and others, have had on these declines in support for basic American values, what is clear is that these declines harm us and help them. For those authoritarian nations wishing to depose America and the West as the global superpower, a steep decline in patriotism is a dream come true. The American political and media class need to take a long, sobering look in the mirror. Sadly, these steep declines in patriotism and tolerance, the vicious othering of those with whom we disagree, can generate votes and clicks, but at a price far too dear for America to pay. If there is a sliver of silver around the cloudy disposition of the American body politic, it may be that we are waking up to external threats, especially those posed by China. A separate Gallup poll found that in 2018, 53% of Americans had a positive view of the communist nation. Today, that has cratered to a mere and record low 15%. We need leaders who will stress that we are all in this unlikely American experiment together, and that there are powerful global forces who want nothing more than to destroy it. It was Benjamin Franklin who wrote, upon the signing of the Declaration of Independence, that we must all hang together, or most assuredly, we will all hang separately. 246 years later, it is still true. Now is the time for patriotism. Now is the time for community involvement. And now is most assuredly the time for tolerance. In the United States of America, it is never too late. I'm David Marcus, author of Charade, The COVID Lies That Crushed a Nation.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Kilmeade. I want you to join me weekdays at 9 a.m. East as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and, of course, what you think.
Listen live or get the podcast now at BrianKilmeadeShow.com.
Pull up a chair and join me, Rachel Campos Duffy.
And me, former U.S. Congressman Sean Duffy, as we share our perspective on the discussions happening at kitchen tables across America.
Download From the Kitchen Table, the Duffys, at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download podcasts.